Well, Sportslit 101, we teased it a little bit, talking about one of the great baseball teams of all time, the 1927 New York Yankees, and you think immediately of Ruth and Gehrig, but there were other guys on that team, an awfully talented bunch, and one of them, who gets overlooked, the subject of a new book.
Yeah, Tony Lazzeri. When I remember my grandfather, who, as I mentioned before, lived to be 105, sharp as a tack, and he could remember ball players. He was a Red Sox fan. He had played in the Cape Cod League. But he loved Murderers Row because he just had incredible respect for how good they were. And he would always say to people, I'll tell you what, the guy they couldn't have done without is Lazzeri. Well, Babe Ruth said the same thing. Miller Huggins, McGraw, all these people said the same thing. And he was one of those guys that got into the Hall of Fame through the Veterans Committee, who should easily, after his 14-year career, been in the Hall of Fame to begin with, especially when you realize that he was born in 1903. There was no major league baseball team on the West Coast in his lifetime. He died before the Giants and the Dodgers moved to L.A. and San Francisco. But he was part of a tradition. He was the first Italian-American star. They called him Push 'Em Up Tony, was his nickname. And he is credited with bringing Italian-Americans into baseball. It wasn't a game that they didn't love it the way the Irish did and the way that other ethnic groups did. And because he was from San Francisco, he was the predecessor to Three DiMaggio's, Grassetti, all kinds of great Italian-American ball players who came later. And when he started out, he was working in a mill making boilers, same place his dad did, playing semi-pro ball. And he was considered an all-hit, no glove fielder. He was 165 pounds, 5'7" or 5'8" at the height of his career, and he was a home run hitter. Mm. He was third in the league behind Gehrig and Ruth on more than one occasion.
Wow.
And obviously Ruth's numbers were gaudier than anybody's. He was, if you look at his career stats, his career final line, it's really good. And Lawrence Baldassaro started learning about Tony Lazzeri when he was researching a book, which I have, but I have not had a chance to read, on Joe DiMaggio. And what he discovered was this incredible journey for Lazzeri to get to the bigs and stay there. He played for the Salt Lake City Bees for a number of years. It took a long time in those days for guys to get to the majors. But Colonel Rupert was willing to spend some cash on Lazzeri because he believed in him. And he was considered the MVP of those the Murderers Row team and the great Yankee teams of that era. But we need to remember, they didn't win a lot of pennants in a row then. They come in the 30s and 40s to win a lot of pennants in a row, and the five in the row at one spot. I forget which years those were. By then, Joe DiMaggio was the big star. And who mentored Joe DiMaggio? Tony Lazzeri. What he stands out among the memories of ball players as doing something most ball players didn't do. If they saw the kid that was going to take his place, the last thing they were going to do was help him. But they said Lazzeri was just the other way. He was so eager to help people, and he thought he would eventually become a manager. He was never given the chance to manage in the majors, though it was expected often that he would. He was considered better managerial material than Ruth, who, as McGraw once said, he can't manage himself. How could he manage a baseball team? He was considered a better manager than material than Hornsby or Cobb, guys that got the chance to manage. One of the thoughts was that he was, quote, a swarthy person. He was a dark complexion. His family was from southern Italy, from southern Tuscany. And that what really was unknown to the public, but was known through baseball, was that he was epileptic. Mm-hmm. And he, and nothing was believed to be more likely to kick off an epileptic seizure than stress. You're talking about playing Major League Baseball, right? He never had any kind of a seizure, which they would call fits in those days. And we know that's not what it is. A seizure, he never had one playing. He had a few before games and a few after games. And for part of his career, he roomed with another ball player who's was familiar with it because there was epilepsy in his family. Now, here's the interesting thing. Who else suffered from epilepsy? Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Yes, yeah.
Now, and why is that a footnote to this story? on Grover Cleveland Alexander's plaque in the Hall of Fame, they mention him coming into a game, which he was apparently still very drunk and hungover from the night before, and getting the final out, striking out a rookie, Tony Lazzari. And Lazzari never seemed to be as bitter as other people were that that's on that Hall of Fame plaque, because I'll tell you what, Grover Cleveland Alexander belongs in the Hall of Fame, and the numbers are there. You wouldn't argue with that. So does Tony Lazzari. But your big thing on your plaque is you struck out a rookie in a World Series game? I mean, come on, you're Grover Cleveland Alexander. I don't care how drunk or hungover he was at the time. You know, that's who he was. And that became part of something that stung Lazzari. And a lot of people think it made him push to be a better ball player all the time. He had injury problems at different times. He was, in those days, they played baseball with a different kind of abandon. I mean, you didn't ever try and slide around a catcher. You tried to go through him, And so it probably took a greater toll on ball players, the game, than it does today. And they didn't have the kind of nutrition or the exercise regimens or the knowledge of kinesiology that baseball players have today. He was in a game once where there were 22 runs scored, and the game took 2 hours and 16 minutes. But we also know that things would... But he played all the infield positions. They tried him a little bit at first. He played in the outfield. He had been a pitcher, and he would sometimes pitch. And I think he wasn't a Wade Boggs knuckleballer, but he was a guy that could come in and get strikes and get people out. But the amazing story about him is that so much of his world is hidden from us because he had to keep so many things quiet.
Mm.
He and his wife... did not, though Colonel Rupert tried to say they did when he had a bad year because they lost a lot of money in the Depression. Clearly they didn't. He was an excellent golfer, and he was a guy that was loved by the New York press. They liked him, and all big city presses can be tough on ball players, and they would say things like, Tony may finally be at the end of his run, and he would have some bounce back year. The reason I'm not going into too many of the details is because the story unfolds. Baldessaro does a great job with this. The story unfolds much like a novel. I mean, it's a nonfiction book, and he did a tremendous amount of research. But he's doing it with Miller Huggins and Babe Ruth and all these people dead. So he had to do a lot of research in newspapers, which he did. He got a lot of the details of Lazzari's life, which unfortunately ended. He either had a seizure and fell on the stairs of his home, or he had a heart attack. They didn't know. His birth records were lost in the San Francisco earthquake. So there was all his name got spelled a whole bunch of different ways. Was he Antonio Marco Lazzari, or was he Anthony Michael Lazzari? Well, he was probably Antonio Marco Lazzari because his father was Agostino, and his mother was much older than his dad. I mean, he had a fascinating story, but he is the first Italian-American baseball star. There was another guy who played ahead of him who changed his name, but he's the guy that opens the door for all those great Italian-American stars that come later, and it's hard for us to think that there had been at one time a reluctance because someone was Italian to bring them onto a baseball
right,
team.
Right. Or that for a time, like during the war years, the World War I years, that was used as a reason to get people to stay away from baseball because they had, at the time, a lot of Germans that were playing the game.
And I'll tell you, the terrible thing is the racial slurs that were used on the press all the time, the happy fascists, they would call Italian ball players just because of Mussolini, right? They used the acronym for without papers, and that was what he was known as, the Wallop and Womp. Can you imagine that? And that would be in newspapers, across the radio land, pictures caricaturing him. And this is from the hometown press, too, not right, just the out-of-town press. It's phenomenal to think about it. The unkind slurs used against Italian Americans were used against him with impunity, and so in a lot of ways he was a He didn't have to fight what Jackie Robinson had to fight. Now, I would never equate the two things. But he did have to endure for a long time things that would not have been in print later on in the career. So he's really the great bridge between Miller Huggins and Murderers Row and the great Yankee teams of the 30s and 40s.
And what's the title of the book again?
It's called Tony Lazzari, Yankees Legend and Baseball Pioneer by Lawrence Baldessaro, from our good friends at the University of Nebraska Press. And the other book is called Beyond DiMaggio, Italian Americans in Baseball. And he's got other books about Italian American baseball. But we will get to that before the summer's over, the other one.
Excellent. And next week we'll be talking about, the first edition, the prequel, if you will, of the book we discussed last week with author Tim Wendell, Castro's Curveball.
Yeah, and this is really good. I liked the other book. This is really, really good. The last 35 pages of this book, and it's all great to get up to there, starts taking turns that you just can't really forget. It is really, really a really neat tale, and it's fiction, but boy, it is steeped in history. It's really good.
Excellent. And I also just got in a book, and I talked with the author online, Luke Eplin. A book is getting great reviews. It's called Our Team, the Epic Story of Four Men and the World Series That Changed Baseball, and it's a look at the 1948 Cleveland Indians through the eyes of Larry Doby, Bill Veeck, Satchel Paige, and Bob Feller.
And I think that'll be the third book we've talked about that has to do with that, because we had the Winning the Pennant book, and we had the other book about Larry Doby. So, yeah, I mean, I personally find that a very fascinating time, because 1948 is just enough after the war and just before the 50s start to hit their stride, that's sort of a no man's land in some ways. And
I had the privilege of meeting Larry Doby a number of years ago at the what was then the NSSA, National Sports Writers and Sportscasters Association Awards, and Jerry Eisenberg, our friend Jerry, was being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and Larry Doby was his presenter who introduced him, and Jerry introduced me to Larry Doby and had a chance to sit and talk with him for, 20 minutes, half hour or so. And what an incredible person he was.
Yeah. And it's so easily swept under the rug that he was in the American League, you know, which was known to be the more racist of the two leagues. And what did he come in 2 weeks after Robinson?
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
With all of the grief and none of the acclaim.
And none of the acclaim, none of the fanfare. And he was a solid, good player, Larry Doby.